Very good. So now for the talk, which is supposed to be about forgiveness and compassion. So first of all, please forgive me for that terrible joke beforehand. Now, you may know that I've been a Buddhist since I was 16, reading my first book, and I am now 784. And I cannot lie to you. A Buddhist monk always tells the truth. I am 784 months since I was born, which is more awesome than actually saying it in years. So it's just over 65. So I've been a monk almost 50, or meditating a Buddhist over almost 50 years now. And one of the things which attracted me to be a Buddhist was when I started reading about Buddhism, I never found any record of punishment, only of forgiveness. Even when somebody did something bad, we were still supposed to compassionately forgive them instead of punish them. And that was actually quite strange to me, because I came from a society, as you did, I was born in Acton, in London, where if you did something wrong, you'd better watch out, because you would be punished. And that creates a lot of problems in our society. The first story to illustrate this was later on when I was a monk, when I became a senior monk, when I'd been a monk for such a long time that some of these young people in Australia had literally grown up with me. They came to meet me first of all when they were in their mother's tummy, when they were fetuses. And actually there's a lot to be said for that, because I know many people who started listening to my talks while they were pregnant. One person in particular, her husband got a job in the Middle East, in Dubai, and she was not allowed to work. So all she did all day was listen to my Dhamma talks while she was pregnant. And after she gave birth, she came to visit me, and as soon as I started talking, the baby lifted its head up. He recognized me by the voice. And that's happened many, many times. So I teach people not just from cradle to grave, way before cradle and way after the grave. It's a much longer surface than you get in any other religion. And so these people grow up with me. And so they have an extra member of their family to help them when they're in difficulty, such as this 16 or 17 year old Sri Lankan girl who came to see me one day in the temple and said, "Ajahn Brahm, I need your help." I said, "Yeah, that's what I'm here for." I said, "I'm in trouble." "What trouble?" She said, "I'm pregnant with my boyfriend." I said, "Have you told your mother and father yet?" And she said, "No, that's why I've come to see you. I want you to tell them for me." I said, "Why don't you tell them?" I said, "My dad will kill me when he finds out." And of course, I was actually felt quite privileged that I could help this little 17-year-old girl out of a really tight spot. You know, to talk to her parents, say, "Come on, people make mistakes. You know, it's not the end of the world." You know, and also from that experience, I started to wonder. She said she can't tell her parents because her dad would kill her. Her dad wouldn't kill her, but she'd certainly get a scolding and maybe punished. And that's why she was afraid of telling her parents. At a time she needed her parents' help more than ever, she was afraid to tell them. And that opened up a lot of the reason why people have problems, especially why they lie to their mum and dad. If your son has trouble with drugs, would he tell you? Or would he be so afraid that he'd hide it from his parents because he's afraid what you would do to him once you found out? They were afraid of punishment, and because of that, they hide the truth. At a time they need their parents more than ever, their parents are distant from them because of fear of being punished. Now, when I heard that, that is not a wise way to have a family. Are your children, are they confident to tell you when they're in trouble? To get your help when they need it desperately? Or are they going to hide it from you and lie? They will lie, they will hide, if they're afraid. So I've asked many parents, please tell your children that they can tell you anything, even things they've done which you'll be ashamed of, which you'll be concerned about, which means they're in big trouble. Please tell them you can tell me anything, son, daughter. As long as it's the truth, you will never ever get punished or scolded. If they lie, fair enough. But if they tell the truth, there has to be amnesty. Otherwise, your children will never tell you the truth. They'll hide it from you. The same with husbands and wives. Even though I've never been married, I know everything about marriage. You'd be surprised at what a monk knows. There was one occasion I invited to participate in a seminar by our by our state government. They wanted feedback from the general public about transport, trucking, railways. And I was a member of the public because I knew the minister. And during this day-long seminar, they had their lunch break afternoon. And so, being a good monk who keeps his precepts, I couldn't have anything to eat because it was after the cut-off time for monks. So, I was just hanging around. And a man came to see me. He said, I'm a reporter and I want to interview you about shipping. And I was bored, nothing to do. So, okay, I'm up for almost anything. So he interviewed me about shipping. And I thought this was a good way of wasting time. But to my surprise, I saw that gentleman 3 months later, and this is absolutely true. He said, Ajahn Brahm, I published that article. He gave it a stupid name, Buddhism and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm. But, that's what he called it. But, he said that article was syndicated over every major shipping journal in the world. And he got all these emails back from these professors and experts who said to him, who is this Ajahn Brahm? We've never heard of Ajahn Brahm, but he certainly knows what he's talking about. I didn't know what I was talking about. But still, you could answer all their questions accurately. So the power of a monk is great. So, at this seminar that's a seminar about shipping, when it comes to and jet lag and tired. Sorry?
Marriage.
Yes, I know all about marriage. That! Why is it that husbands and wives lie to each other? They do, don't they? Why? Because they too are afraid of being punished and scolded. If he found out what I was doing, I'd be in big trouble. If she found out what I'm up to, whoa, she'll go ballistic. That's not a good marriage. Of all people, the one you're committed to in this life, your husband, your wife, your partner, of all people, they should be the person you can say anything to. And I literally mean anything. And you're telling them because you know you're not perfect, you've made a mistake, you're sharing your weakness with them. And they should have enough trust and love not to scold you, but say, well, that's a really stupid thing you've done, wife, but I'm here to help you. How can we make sure this never happens again? If there's that amnesty in a marriage, then the partner has one other person they can trust and lean on when they really need some help. Unfortunately, what happens these days, you don't tell. You hide. Because you're afraid of punishment. And that's also the same in politics. Why do politicians lie? Because if they told the truth, they'd be out of a job. They too make mistakes. In summary, punishment, or rather the fear of punishment, is what drives the truth underground. So no one really knows what's going on. In Buddhism, we do have five precepts. One of them is not lying. And I thought, why do Buddhists lie? And the reason is because of punishment and fear of being punished. So that is why, if we can somehow have another ethos, another way of looking at life, where there is not punishment, but its opposite, forgiveness, amnesty, no punishment, but help, learning, growth, when anyone makes a mistake. And that's what really impressed me with Buddhism. If you want to read this, the Buddha said it again and again in the sutras. If you acknowledge your mistake, in other words, confess it, no punishment, learn from it, then that's called growth. That's how we learn and grow and do better next time. An example of that, which actually happened in a monastery where I am the abbot, the boss monk, the dictator, whatever you wish to call me, in Perth. Many of you go to places like Chithurst. You understand the way monasteries work in our tradition. If you want to become a monk or a nun, you first of all have to be what's called anagarika, keeping eight precepts for at least a year. It's where we can test you out, find out what you're really made of, find out if you are monk material. And after 1 year of being an anagarika, you can ordain as a novice monk. Do you know what the word novice means? No vice. That's what it is, no vice monks. So they should be pure enough to get at least the worst of their vices out of the way. And they train for another year. Only after 2 years can they become a full monk or a nun, a bhikkhuni. We call that, in Buddhism, quality control, QC. So we only want monks and nuns who really want to be there, who are not going to embarrass you or us, and they were really well trained. So that is a system. So I had an anagarika who had only just come to our monastery. He wasn't really all that understanding of what a monk should do, but he did know the rules, the 8 precepts, one of which is similar to the monks and nuns of not being able to eat after noon until the dawn of the following day. So one morning this young Australian man came to see me, very distressed. He said he hadn't slept all night. He said he was so disturbed. He was guilty, he said, because the previous afternoon he was hungry. And when no one was around, when we were all meditating in our huts, he crept into the kitchen and he took out some bread and made himself a sandwich. And even worse, he ate it. He broke his precepts. And that's why he felt so guilty he couldn't sleep all night. And he had to come up to me, the boss, the abbot, the dictator. Not really dictator. I'm called actually the spiritual director, but people nickname me the spiritual dictator. But he was so guilty. He was so upset. And I told him, in Buddhism, wonderful, you've acknowledged your mistake. So well done for being brave enough to tell me. Number 2, I told him all the things a monk or a nun can eat and drink in the afternoon, which is took me about half an hour because it's so much. Chocolate, cheese, orange juice, honey, crystallized ginger. If you've been to Chithurst, you know the whole lot. So if you're really hungry, you can take some of that. Or even better, eat more at lunchtime so you don't get hungry in the afternoon. So I gave him all this advice. You don't need to break your precepts. Other ways of dealing with the problem. Okay, now you can go. And he looked at me and said, I can go? Yes. You mean you're not going to punish me? I said, we don't do punishment in Buddhism. And he said, that's not good enough. He complained. He said, I know my character. If you don't punish me, give me some penance, I know I will do it again tomorrow. So he was one of these people who expected when you make a mistake, you get punished. And if you don't get punished, you'll do it again. That's how people are trained in this country. But I said, that's not how we do it. But he insisted. He said, you must give me a punishment. So he put me on the spot. And it just so happened that that night before, I had been reading a history book about Australia, about the convicts who were sent over to Australia. We've changed that now. So please tell Ajahn Karuniko in Chithurst and also Ajahn Amaro, you can't send the naughty monks over to Australia anymore. That time is gone. We'll take the good monks, but not the bad ones. But that time is gone. But in those days, the British soldiers treated those convicts abominably. If they made any mistake, they were beaten with this really sadistic whip called the Cat of Nine Tails. I'm sure you've read about that or seen it in movies. It was brutal, but it was the tradition. So, when this young man said he wanted a punishment, that was in the front of my mind. So, if that's what you want, young man, I will sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat. That's what I said. And this young man, you know Anagarikas wear white, his face went whiter than the clothes he was wearing. and his lips started to quiver. He actually thought that Ajahn Brahm was going to whip him. And that's when I explained to him what 50 strokes of the cat mean in a Buddhist monastery. At that time, we happened to have two little cats. Find one of them and stroke it. 1, 2, 50 times. Learn some compassion, you hard-hearted, wanting to be punished young man. So that was his punishment, to stroke the cat 50 times. Now that was not just a joke, that was real, because when he stroked the cat, he had enough compassion to understand his weaknesses and to learn from them, instead of wanting to hurt himself because of his mistakes. Why do we want to hurt ourselves for our mistakes? Is enough hurt been done already? Isn't there another way? And that is that way. Acknowledge, confess your mistakes, which when there's no punishment you're more likely to do. Forgiveness, which means you make mistakes, I make mistakes. No, we are all sort of fallible in all sorts of different ways. And learn from it, which is the most important. Many of us, when we make mistakes, we never get to learning because we hide the truth. Well, I didn't do that, not me. It's not my fault. Somebody else did that. Not me. I'm innocent, really. When you're guilty. So instead, we forgive, and that's where the learning happens. So this is part of fundamental Buddhism. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn, not punishment. However, Buddhism is still not the dominant religion in places like Australia and England, which is why people don't understand why you should forgive. Number one, it makes the truth come to the surface, because we're not afraid to tell the truth. When there's no punishment, there's forgiveness. And number two, it allows learning to happen. In other words, we've made a mistake, let's find out why and do something about it so it's less likely to happen ever again. So that is the reason behind forgiveness. Now, how do we forgive? Because there are some people in this world, you think it's impossible to forgive. They've done such mean and nasty and cruel things to you. They don't deserve forgiveness. May they rot in hell for eternity. What a cruel thing that is to say or to think. No. There is no person in this world who is so bad that they don't deserve some forgiveness. You may all remember Desmond Tutu's and Nelson Mandela's Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. That was so Buddhist, and that actually stopped a civil war after Nelson Mandela became the president. Remember, he was 26 years in Robben Island. 26 years of his life taken away, the best years, just because of fighting for a principle of his people, black Africans, being treated with respect and dignity. He wasn't a murderer or a bank robber or a rapist. He was just someone who really needed, thought it was the only way to actually redress an obvious wrong. 26 years there, now he was president, he had the full power to get back, to seek revenge on all those people who had hurt him. What did he do? Did he seek revenge? No. Instead, he wanted to find the only way of healing those wounds is actually to find out what happened. And the only way to find out what happened was having amnesty. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was the first of a lot of other similar ideas, where any person who had done any crime, extrajudicial torture and murder, as long as they came and told the truth, they were given amnesty. They could walk free. And I read some of the transcripts of what happened. And one particular one, it just shows, just you can forgive anything. This white African policeman was confessing to how he tortured and killed a black African activist. Now please excuse me, I'm going to be gross here. Not as a joke, to give you an idea, if you didn't know, the sort of thing which happened. This black African activist, taken away in the middle of the night by the security police, interrogated. And how they interrogated a man, taking out, please excuse me, this is gross, taking out his penis, putting a nail through the penis to nail it to the desk to show they were serious, and then the interrogation started. Any guys here, that makes you squirm. When I read that, maybe it's not painful, it's probably it's painful, but it's just so awful to contemplate. And he was saying how he did this and tortured this guy and eventually killed him. And confessing something as gross as that, the man, the police officer was crying, was shaking, emotionally telling the gross things you've done is one of the most difficult things you could ever do. But he wanted to open it up. He needed to do that. He was encouraged. He actually did it. And emotionally he was shaking after he said this. And he said this confession in the courtroom in front of this black African, the dead black African man's wife, the widow. Imagine that's you as that wife, learning how your husband, the father of your children, the man you chose to love, how he was extrajudicially tortured to death. How would you feel? This woman, when the testimony was finished, jumped over the barricades which were supposed to protect, you know, the people confessing their crimes from the victims of that crime. She was big but fast. She dodged two security guards and went for that policeman, went for him. She grabbed him and put her two big arms around him and hugged him and said, "I forgive you." When I read that, even telling you now, I get emotional. Apparently everybody in the court just burst out crying. The judges, everybody. This woman, this widow, had just found out what happened to her husband after he'd been abducted in the middle of the night. Found out how he'd been treated in the grossest way, tortured and killed. And what did she do? "I forgive you." That gave hope that no matter what terrible deeds are done, if she could forgive that, then we can forgive anything. No one has treated you that badly, so why on earth can't you forgive them? Sometimes people say, if you forgive these people, they will just do the same again. They don't, because then you go on to the next step. Once you find out what's happened, no punishment, no revenge, then we can find a way to make sure that that death was not in vain, that something comes out of that. We learn. to make sure there's CCTV cameras in the police stations, no one has that power, that everybody has a proper right to investigate wrongs, whatever it is. There's so many ways, once we know what's wrong, what the error is, to make sure, at least to really make it very much more difficult that any such thing could happen ever again. That is progress. That is how we learn. And I don't like mentioning that story because it's gross, but I mention that story many, many times because sometimes people say to me, what my ex-partner did to me, I can never forgive. What that guy did who killed my son, I can never forgive. You can. You have the choice to forgive. And it's never the case that the crime, the deed is so bad it cannot be forgiven. That takes away the first impediment to forgiveness. They should not be forgiven. The next one, I can't forgive them. You can, but you have to find the way to forgive them. And the way to forgive a person who's really hurt you badly is the first step is to see something in them which makes them worth forgiving. Now, when someone has really hurt you, disappointed you, cheated you, made your life more difficult, you think they're a bastard through and through. There's nothing good in them. They're terrible. The whole lot of them is bad. That is never the case. It's weird, but the people who really hurt you always have some people who love them. Which is really strange at first. How can you love a person like that? Do you know what they did to me? They do. They can see something in that person which you cannot see. So, you have to find some good qualities in them which make them worth saving. It's like having an apple. Yeah, there's a few rotten bits in it, but most of it's okay. So you just take out the rotten bits and save the good bits instead of throwing the whole apple away, the whole person away. So see something in them which is worth forgiving. But oh, I should have said, well, why forgive? One of the reasons why forgive is because they've done some bad karma. Why do you have to be punished for it? Until you forgive them, you're punishing yourself. A very simple example to make this a bit lighter, because it's getting a bit heavy. I can see you, you're not smiling. Someone calls you an idiot. Most people who haven't meditated, haven't been trained, start thinking, why did he call me an idiot? He's got no right to call me an idiot. It's wrong to call me an idiot. And if you've got a little bit of wisdom, a little bit of mindfulness, you realize he's just called you an idiot 3 more times. Every time you remember it, he's called you an idiot again. In fact, if that's the case and you keep remembering it, then he's right, you are an idiot. Instead, if it's not right, let it go. So he can only call you an idiot once, and then it's gone. Someone cheated you at business. You didn't do anything wrong. That guy did the bad karma, so why do you keep thinking, he cheated me, cheated me, cheated me? And every time you remember that, he's cheating you again out of your happiness. You're crazy allowing his or her bad actions to cause you suffering. So, forgiving is in our interests. It's for our peace and happiness. It's actually also for theirs as well. But how about looking at yourself on this? It's not good for your well-being, happiness, even health, if you keep thinking about the past without forgiving. You get sick, emotionally and often physically. So it's in your interest. It's worth doing. In fact, it's crucial that you forgive if you want to be peaceful, happy, and free.
and not such a pain in the ass for the people you live with. So, it's in your interest, anything can be forgiven. You have the choice to forgive if you know how to do it. First step, seeing something in them which is worth forgiving. And once you see that, you realize, hey, they're not such a bad person. When I used to go visiting prisons, it was weird. I went to some high security prisons. I've been to see some famous famous people have done bad things. But in all those years I've been in prison, actually every time I went into prison to teach meditation or whatever, I'd always keep a log of the time I spent in prison, serving and helping. So I know how many hours I spent inside prison to be used as credit in case one day I am sentenced. Hey Judge, I've already done a couple of years. But every time I went into those prisons, I never ever saw a murderer, or a thief, or a paedophile, or a rapist. I've never seen a criminal. All I've ever seen is a person who murdered, not a murderer. A person who stole, not a thief. A person who abused kids, but never a paedophile. Why, no matter how terrible, how cruel, how hurtful, really hurtful, scarring the victims for years, no matter how bad that act, you cannot define them their whole life by the murder they did. That doesn't make them a murderer. It makes them a person who's done a murder. The one who cheated you, they're not a cheat, they're a person who cheated you. The one who let you down is not a let-downer, but a person who's let you down. I learned this, a very simple story. Two children with their mothers in a supermarket, in parallel checkout lanes. They were checking out their groceries, and one kid dropped a carton of milk, and it went splat all over the floor. Almost exactly the same time, the other kid in the parallel aisle dropped a jar of honey, and that cracked and smashed on the floor. The mother of the kid who dropped the milk said, "You stupid child." The mother of the kid who dropped the honey said, "That was a stupid thing you did." That's probably happened to you in the past. There's a world of difference. The kid who dropped the milk, "You stupid child," comes away thinking they're stupid, that their whole being is faulty, that when they were born there was some genetic defect in their character, they're stupid. And that makes them depressed, negative, lack of self-worth, never grow. The second kid, "That's a stupid thing you did," really, they're not a stupid thing, a person, they're not a defective person, they just did a wrong thing which they can learn not to do in the future. Now, I'm sure you've all had that sometimes, "You stupid man, you stupid monk, you stupid nun." It's not a stupid nun sitting next to me. It's a nun who sometimes, I better be careful. But that is why I've never seen a criminal, or a thief, or a murderer. There are no such people as terrorists. There are people who do terrorist things. There's another part of them. You know the interesting thing which I found out? Psychology. I teach psychologists, cutting-edge psychology. Every now and again I see things which I've taught, many, many times, being taught in conferences. For example, some of you have been following me for years on the internet. Someone showed me a video of a psychologist who's making a lot of money using this technique. He said, the problems in life are like the size of your hand. The problem is, can you see my hand now? Now my hand is so big I can't see anyone in this room. Is it the problem is my hand is too big, or is it because I'm holding it too close to me, wrong perspective? If I put my hand over here, where it belongs at the end of my arm, the hand is no smaller, but now I can see all of you as well as the hand. And he's saying, that's the trouble with people. Something occurs in their life, boom, and that's all they can see. They've lost perspective, they can't see anything else. Your wife overspends on the credit card, boom, that's all you can see. Your spendthrift wife. She's not a spendthrift. She's got so many other qualities, but if all you see is the faults, it's like putting your hand so close. Now, I've been teaching that for 20, 30 years. And I saw this psychologist. He's using that as his method to make a fortune, which I don't mind, except he's giving no commission to me. But now, you teach this psychology. So, here we go. There's no such thing as a criminal. Just a person who's done a crime. So when I went into those prisons, that's what I went in for. Never looking at the crime, but looking at the other part of the person. Looking at the part of the person which wasn't a pedophile. Looking at the other part of the person which wasn't a thief. I looked at that. And you know, an incredible thing happened. When I could see the other part of that person, they could see it too. When all I saw was a thief, a murderer, and that's actually what other people saw in them, that's all they knew, and they actually, because they thought they were murderers, they became murderers. That was their identity. When I showed them another part of themselves, a bigger part of themselves, that is where the other part of themselves grew. And I got one of my best compliments in my life. I don't mind praising myself when it's not praising me. It's about praising what I've done. And this was a few years ago. I received a telephone call from one of the prison officers in Western Australia who said, Ajahn Brahm, can you please come back to our prison to teach? I say, I'm too busy supporting Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project, going to London, so many other stuff I get involved in these days. And I said, I'm too busy these days. I'm an emperor, I've got many responsibilities. I'll send another monk. And he said, no, we want you. And my response was, why me? You know, that's what you usually say. Why me? And that's when he gave me the compliment, which will stay with me till I die. He said, I've been in this prison service over 30 years, and I've noticed something very unique. Every prisoner who came to your classes, when they're released, never ever comes back. I've never seen this with anybody else. No recidivism. And that was what really touched me. They never went back to jail afterwards. Once they went to my classes, they were out and started new lives. I thought, why? What have I done? And I think that is what I attribute that success to. I never saw a murderer. I saw the person who'd done the murder. They saw it too. So they realized they weren't a murderer, they weren't a criminal. They're a person who made a big mistake. There's another part to them. So they could forgive, learn, never do it again. That's not just with prisoners. I say go into really interesting areas. My life as a monk is fascinating. I go to places where you guys can never go. And once I did this seminar, keynote address, at the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. They're having their 100th anniversary or something. And just I gave that simile of it's not a criminal, just a person who's done a crime. And afterwards, the head of the schizophrenia unit came up to me to thank me for my talk. Now, you all probably have had contact with schizophrenia, with people who have that terrible disease. It just debilitates their life in and out of hospital. Their family can't stand them because their delusions make them just so difficult to live with. It's a terrible disease, schizophrenia. Destroys people's lives. So he was the head of the schizophrenia unit in Singapore. And I asked him there and then, how do you treat schizophrenia in Singapore? And he told me exactly the same way you just told us about how you treat prisoners. He said, I never treat the schizophrenia. I treat the other part of my patients, the part which isn't schizophrenic. And when I heard that, I broke my rules and I worshipped him. His wisdom. Because I knew that he was on the money. And I asked him, knowing the answer, what are the results? Way better than conventional treatment, he said. And he was a professor, the head, the boss of that unit. That's how you do it. You forgive the schizophrenia. See the other side. Work on that. And basically you squash the schizophrenia out from that patient. Anyone who has cancer. You're not a cancer patient. You're a person who's got a tumor. But most of your body's okay. Tumor's only in a small part of the body. Can you remember that? You're just a person. There's a huge part of you which is not cancerous. I always say whenever you go and see a person in a hospital, never talk to the illness or the disease. Talk to the person. They're much more than the sickness. If they can remember that, you've got a good chance of overcoming that sickness. But often we just see the problem and we don't see the other part. You've a stupid kid. No, you've done a stupid thing. But you're not stupid. You're much bigger than that. So this is called forgiveness. Now, the hardest person to forgive in the whole world, absolutely crazy, yourself. You don't have to live with your enemies. You can move to another city. You can get divorced. You can actually leave your parents. But you can never run away from yourself. Just like me, wherever I go, there I am. I'm supposed to live in Australia. Now I'm in Brighton. Wherever I go. I had a great experience today, just walking down the promenade. This guy came up to me and said, my goodness, are you Ajahn Brahm? I said, yeah, I think so. Then what on earth are you doing in Brighton? I watch you on YouTube every day. He was shocked. I'm supposed to be in Australia. That was really quite cool, that. But anyway, I love my life like that. Always surprising people. So anyway, that when you understand that you can never escape from you, it makes it even more important for your happiness and well-being, you forgive yourself. Why on earth can't you? One of the reasons is because you've been brought up a condition that you're not allowed to. Don't forgive yourself. If you don't forgive yourself and punish yourself, you will do it again. Have you ever noticed when you feel guilty, you do it again? When you forgive yourself, you don't do it again. It's just a simple lack of self-worth. When you don't forgive yourself, you think you're flawed. There's something missing in your brain or whatever, which means you don't think you're worthy of moving forward. Lack of self-esteem, guilt, lack of self-worth. And when that gets very, very strong, that is the main cause of addictions to alcohol, to drugs, to actually self-sabotage. Sabotaging relationships, sabotaging your career, because you don't think you're good enough because you haven't forgiven yet. So, in order to forgive yourself, please look at some good things in you to realize you are worth forgiving. The bad things is just, yes, they are real, you did those things, put them in context, they're not such a big deal. I was talking to one prisoner in jail, and he's talking to him about this. He said, look, I'm hopeless. I've really done lots of bad things in my life. So I said, we are going to do an exercise. And I got a sheet of paper out of a book. I drew a line down the middle of that book. And I wrote his name on the top. And I asked him, on the left-hand side of this line, please write down all the terrible bad things you have done. I won't show it to people, just write it down. And he wrote and wrote and wrote, filled in every line and in the margin and between the lines all the terrible things he'd done in his life. Once it was all filled in, couldn't get any more in, okay, that's enough. Now on the right side of the piece of paper, write all the good things you have done. And he said, there's nothing to put in there. I said, it must be. He said, no, I'm just totally bad. So I started pushing him, and I got the first entry in there. He said, have you got a cat? He said, yeah, I got a cat. Did you feed it some milk? I said, actually, yes, I did. I fed it some milk. Put that down. I gave the cat some milk. This is actually true. This is what happened. And then, okay, what else you've done which is good? Oh, I woke my neighbour up because he had to get up early. Great, put that down. And you know, it was like the crack in the damn wall. Once you got that first thing down, I fed the cat, the other good things started to flow. And once you get to the fifth or sixth, they just flew and flew and flew as he saw all the good qualities in him, which were many. Every one of you. Look, honestly, Donald Trump has got some very beautiful qualities. He has. Maybe you can't see them yet, but I'm sure he fed the cat some milk this morning. And then I told them, right, now, get the scissors and cut that piece of paper down the middle with the line. And I say, give me the left-hand part with all your faults. And I threw it in the bin. The right-hand part with all your good qualities. If you possibly can, photocopy it 100 times, laminate it, put it in your desk, by your bag, in your wallet, everywhere. Because I want you to remember, you're not a totally bad person. You've done some good things, you've done some good qualities. I want you to remember those and focus, not on the bad things you've done, which you have done, but focus on your kindness, your compassion, your generosity, which everybody has some. And then those good qualities started to grow. As he noticed them, remembered them, reflected upon them, saw them, he became a much better person. Until he realized, actually, he was not that bad. This guy, apparently, he went around the prison, because other people were telling me, he went around the prison, finally saying, it's only two bad bricks. He'd murdered two people.
It's only two bad, that's all, it's just two murders. That's all. Now that fellow got it. So I'm not sure if he's been released now, but when he will be released, he won't do any bad things anymore. He will find, because he's got self-worth now, he will find a life. And good on him for doing that. So this is how we forgive ourselves, a little ceremony like that. Now if you're really a hard case, and you just cannot let go of the bad things which you have done, we take that writing it on a piece of paper to the next level. I don't know, some of you are such hard cases. Forgive, but I've done terrible things, let it go, but I can't. And it's true, you can't just decide to let go. You do need something much more solid, a ceremony. So we do have this forgiveness ceremony, which I developed. And I remember after developing it, when I told it at a conference of psychologists in Sydney, as soon as they heard it, they were all writing it down. So they could actually do it in their therapy sessions and charge their clients hundreds of dollars for what they got from me for free. They're terrible people, but I've forgiven them. So, taking it to the next level is this. The paper, change it. The ink, change it. And the ceremony, adapt it. Instead of using ordinary paper, choose toilet paper. It's very cheap, and one roll you can write a lot on it. And the ink, brown ink from a felt tip pen. Dark brown ink, maybe a little bit darker than that. And when you write down all the things you cannot forgive about yourself, all the terrible things which you have done, all the things which mean I wish I hadn't done that. Write it down in dark brown ink on toilet paper. It's called in psychology association with the other dark brown stuff which goes on toilet paper. Now, I don't know how environmentally conscious you are, but apparently even the head of the World Wildlife Fund never uses both sides of the toilet paper. Wasting trees. Even you, when you've got even a little bit of brown on a piece of toilet paper, only a tiny bit, you don't fold it up and put it in your pocket to use later on, because there's still many clean parts which you can still be used. Even a tiny bit of shit on a piece of toilet paper and you throw it away. That's quite rightly so, it's disgusting, unhealthy, stinky. So there you get the association. When you write all the terrible things you've done in brown ink on toilet paper, you need the felt tip pen, otherwise it doesn't work. You write it down on toilet paper, the association is that this is not something you should fold up in your pocket and keep. And that's what you've been doing for years, because you haven't forgiven yet. You write it down, and when you finish writing it down, reinforcing the association of what this really is, it's shit. And as I say, just because sometimes people criticize me, they say, Ajahn Brahm, a monk shouldn't say the word shit. And I argue with them. I know my Buddhism, my suttas and my Vinaya. And it's said clearly in both the sutta, that's the Aranavibhanga Sutta, and in the Vinaya. The Buddha told the monks, monks, you must teach in the local language. This is Brighton, you use the word shit, so must I. Okay, so there you go, don't argue. So you associate it with the other stuff which goes on toilet paper, shit. So you write it all down,
the association, it takes a long time, it takes effort, mindfulness to write things down. That's why it's really reinforced. This is shit, you should not be keeping it. So you read it, and then you do the final part of the ceremony, the letting go ceremony. And you take that piece of toilet paper with all the stuff you've never forgiven yet into the letting go room. Which I don't need to explain what that is. And don't put it in the bowl yet. You read it again. Totally, slowly, not speed reading, you've got to reinforce. This is what you've done, it's brown on toilet paper, and after reading a second time, only then do you put it in the toilet bowl where it belongs, and you press the button, and the toilet paper with all that shit on it, all of the stuff which you haven't let go of yet, goes around, round the bend and out of your life forever, into the sewers where it belongs. That is called the letting go ceremony. Now, you may think that's a joke. Yeah, it's funny, and that is the way I make sure you remember it. But it actually works. It's a ceremony. And you do something. The associations, the reinforcement is there all along the way, which makes it easier to let it go. And the association, it's not worth keeping that stuff. So please, for goodness sake, let it go. And when you let go of all the bad stuff you've done, that is called forgiveness. Let it go, forgiveness. Why? Out of compassion for the people you live with, for your kids, for your parents, for the people you work with. As I say, everyone who has to put up with you, let alone for yourself. Who likes to live with a depressed, angry, miserable person? I don't. I like living with happy people. The people who are free. The people who don't always, oh, I shouldn't have done this. Oh, I'm depressed. Oh, I want to commit suicide. Oh. Come on! Let it go. That's a great ceremony to be able to do it. You do it out of compassion for others and also for compassion for yourself. And, of course, you don't stop there. All along, you're learning and growing. It still hurts, so make sure you never do it again. Find means, mindfulness, so you can catch yourself before you do stupid things. And just the learning how to be more generous, one of the great ways is hanging out with good people. One of my books, somebody asked me to sign it, the American version is called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. In Asia it's known as Good, Bad, Who Knows. In Germany, it's called The Elephant Who Lost His Happiness. And it got to number 3 on the bestseller list of all books. I was really proud of that. Number 3. It was a Buddhist book. There's whole sections, apparently, in bookshops in Germany with that book in. And that particular title was used based on a Jataka tale about an elephant, a royal elephant, which was like the Mercedes-Benz, the Rolls-Royce of people those days. In those days, not like Queen Elizabeth with a roller, an elephant. Because it's a waste of time having a Rolls-Royce in the jungle, get stuck. Elephants can go anywhere. Okay. So, had a big elephant, but that elephant, it was a very well-behaved elephant, started misbehaving. Started pooing. Shitting just when the trainer was right behind it. And if ever you've seen elephant shit, it's a lot. And started shooting water at the king. Didn't know why he'd suddenly changed his behavior to being a bad elephant. So the king got the vet and tried to find out, was the elephant sick? No sign of any disease at all. Don't know why he suddenly changed his character. So a wise minister decided to spend the night next to the elephant stall to find out. Was meditating all night. And about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, heard a sound behind the elephant stall.
There's a band of bikies, Hell's Angels. We're meeting there every evening. I'm just making this up as I go along. I always change the stories to make them more interesting for me as well as for you. If you think you've heard these stories before, I've heard them many more times than you. So I like playing around with them. So a band of Hell's Angels were behind the elephant stall, meeting there every evening to see who they would beat up for not paying their drug debts, to see who they could rob, to see where they can sell more methamphetamines ice. They were bad people. And they were meeting behind the elephant store because that was secret. No one would think they were there. But the wise minister saw them, or rather heard them, and suddenly realized why the elephant had changed his nature. Even though elephants can't understand human language, they pick up on the attitude, the vibration. So, straight away, the minister knew what to do. He had all those bikies arrested the next night, and he replaced them with monks and nuns every other night. If you have the monks and nuns spending the night together, that'd be a lot of So, alternate nights, monks and nuns. So, just having the monks talking Dhamma, meditating, doing loving kindness, in a few days, elephants came back to being a good elephant again. Just because you pick up on the people close to you. So if you actually give up and forgive yourself, you'll create a lot of peace and happiness for the people you live with, whether you intend it or not. It is worth your while. So that's actually how we forgive and learn and grow and make a much better world. And I have now been told to question and answer, and I'm a well-behaved monk. So, that is the end of the forgiveness talk. Now, questions and answers. So, who's got any comments about the talk I have just given? No? Then I can carry on giving another talk. Gotta go.
Half past nine.
Okie dokie. So, a question. Thank you.
I have a question. I'm 37 years old, and it's a bit irrelevant to this, and I have a small toy dog that I'm really attached to, and it's a great comfort for me when I'm feeling down or when I'm in pain. What is the appropriate way I should be feeling about this toy within Buddhism that I'm really, really attached to? That gives me comfort. What's appropriate, what's right?
You mean it's not like a woof-woof dog?
It's a toy.
That's a much better. It doesn't need to be taken to a kennel when you go away. It doesn't need to be fed. It doesn't need to be taken downstairs to go to the toilet. A toy one is much better than a real one. Wonderful. I encourage you to use that as a thing which encourages loving kindness. It's a skillful means.
I don't have to let it go.
No, as long as it's creating positive, good things for you. At the recent retreat, which we did in yesterday morning or something, I don't know, generally. Okay, we had a teddy bear, which I bought from my retreat centre in, from Perth. We have about 30 or 40 teddy bears in my retreat. And during my retreat, everybody is encouraged to meditate with a teddy bear. You put it in your lap, you cuddle it, and it actually makes your meditation way better. I won't explain it here. Tomorrow in Kairos Center, for anyone who's going there, you will find that one of the biggest impediments or weaknesses for success in meditation is a lack of kindness.
Do you know what that's called?
Bear awareness.
Plushophilia.
Plushophilia?
Yes.
It's got a name.
Yeah, loving stuffed animals.
Excellent. Yeah, I suffer as well. But in Buddhism, we have another name for it. When you're holding a teddy bear and practicing mindfulness, I already told you, bear awareness. And that's much older than plush of whatever it is. So, there's a name for everything. But I teach psychologists, and so that's a lot of bullshit. If it works, go for it.
Thank you.
Is that your partner next to you?
I've not met him before, but it's
all right. Okay, well, I've got an opening there. But be careful, because boys are just like stuffed animals.
As long as it's furry.
Furry. He's got a beard, so he's getting there. But... yeah. Oh, no, my other bears went from one of... Yes, you've got a question. Yes?
You've spoken at a personal level.
Yes.
You've mentioned the dreaded Trump word.
Oh.
We have chaos in America. We have fair chaos here. We have chaos in Thailand. Which is very dear to your heart and mine. Okay, I can think about loving kindness within myself.
Yes, yeah.
But it disappears into nothingness against this
term. Oh, the Trump, the coup in Thailand. How about looking at the other side of America? Which... politics will never change. You go to America, there's so many kind, generous, they're incredibly hospitable there. Some really, really smart people. I went into Google and also Facebook. As a monk, I can open doors which other people can't do. So I went into Google headquarters and sat in their meditation room. And I was also invited into Facebook. And they've also got a meditation room. So these are some really innovative people. There's many good people. In Thailand, I was out there last September, giving a keynote address at a conference for bhikkhunis. There's so many beautiful people in Thailand. So if you focus on the bad people, Mr. Trump, it can fill your whole perception and you get very... very dispirited and very negative about the prospects in that country. He is just amplified. He's great media fodder. But after the election, I'll forget about him. That's the trouble with the media. They just tell people what they want to read. We like to read scandals, bad stuff, but being in Thailand, it's still going the same old Thailand as it was before. If you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, then you see all that stuff. But 99% is great. I was told that poor old Britain after Brexit is falling apart. And I come here, and you're still the same as you were last time I was here. So sometimes we exaggerate way too much. What we're doing, we're putting the hand right in front of us. Put it out there. And I guarantee, the world will not be the same. But Mr. Trump, Brexit, Thailand, Kim Jong-un, he's just a misunderstood, lonely man. A bit of kindness, compassion. I don't know. Anyway, I'm only making this up. But anyway, it's not as bad as you think. When I was young, I was taught that nuclear war is imminent. I really thought there'd be a nuclear war, as many people in my generation thought. Never happened. Many people actually stocked up with food for when it happened. Never happened. So a lot of times we have a lot of fear. Many of you, I live in Western Australia. And every now and again we have bushfires. And people actually called up, are you okay, Ajahn Brahm? There's a bushfire in Western Australia. Mate, Western Australia is bigger than Europe. Okay, so maybe there's a bushfire in Brighton, but it doesn't affect sort of Moscow. But that's what people do, they just exaggerate. So it's fine. They have a joke that Australian psychologists, they don't need to work much at all. All they do when people come into their rooms, no matter what mental problems they have, they just say, she'll be right.
See you next week. It's a positive attitude. And a lot of time, it is right. There's something also I said just before to someone. You know, fear of the future. Have you ever noticed that what you fear is going to happen, happens? You actually make it happen, you create it. Understanding that, actually this is very profound. Now, I know the nature of the mind probably better than most, I'm certainly better than all of you. The mind is incredibly powerful as a creator. And if you're afraid of something happening, you're actually contributing, making it happen. If you're afraid of getting cancer, you're increasing the odds of getting cancer, I don't know, about 1000-fold. If you're afraid, that's what's going to happen. If you're afraid that your relationship is not going to last, you are destroying your relationship. If you're afraid that the economy of this country is not going to go well after Brexit, you are contributing to that problem. Fear tends to fulfill what it's afraid of. Be really careful there. We're starting this Anukampa Bhikkhuni project, trying to get a place where females can have equal opportunity to ordain to the highest level in Bhikkhunis, have the same support, so that next time I don't need to give this talk, she can. Why is it only monks who give talks? Why can't the Dalai Lama be a woman? Why do all the senior teachers have to be men? Doesn't make sense to me, so I'm doing something about it. And people say, come on, it costs too much money. Even we're just looking at a property in Brighton, the London by the Sea, I heard it was called. It's too expensive. If you think like that, it will never happen. Me? No problem. We'll get the money from somewhere. That attitude means it will happen. Be careful of negativity. I know enough history about this country. 100 years ago, it was a can-do country. Building a bigger ship, we can do it. A bigger bridge, yeah, we'll find a way. It's incredible. A greater aircraft, we can do it. That attitude was one of the reasons for the success of this nation. Now, yeah, it won't work. Nah, we haven't got the money. Nah, it's too hard. That is a terrible, bad cycle. That's like the manager of Manchester United saying, nah, you're not going to win this match. Nah, you can't score any goals. A manager like that would get the sack. But a manager who says, yeah, the ball is round. You know, you've got two legs like everybody else. You can do it, you can win. That manager creates success. So for goodness sake, never think, I can't do it. Think like that and you won't be able to. Think, why not? And then it happens. And I have got a reputation of delivery. Whatever I put my mind to, it actually works. I know how it works. It's mine. That is called the secret. Not in the secret in a book, the secret you heard from Buddhist monks. You don't need to buy the book. This is a much better secret. Next question. Does that answer the question? Hope so. Very good. Now, one of my possibilities. Yeah. Now, one of the things which I'm planning to do is, I know the Dalai Lama says, oh, I'm not trying to convert anybody. That is also bullshit. It's part of our job, obviously. If I really think Buddhism is really worthwhile, of course I'll be trying to get other people to do it. If I have a cure for cancer, of course I'm going to give it to other people. I'm not going to keep it for myself. But, you know, it's so difficult. So, you know, presenting Buddhism in a country like UK
when it's not enough resources for Buddhists. Now, we don't really have, you know, our own TV channel or, you know, access to people in high power. So, I always think, you know, it's an old Chinese saying, you're going to kill the snake, you've got to go for the head. So, my goal in the next few years is to convert Queen Elizabeth to be a Christian. Now, she's getting old now. She must be thinking about what happens to her when she passes away. She must be considering reincarnation. And Buddhism, we have the goods on dying. We know more about dying than Christians and Jews and Muslims. You know why? Because Christians, Muslims and Jews, they only die once. We die many times. We reincarnate. So we know more because we have more experience about dying. That's logic. So I just want this to happen, to be able to convert the Queen Elizabeth to being a Buddhist. Now, once she is a Buddhist, she's the head of the Anglican Church. So if she's a Buddhist, then all the Archbishop of Canterbury, he has to become a Buddhist too, all the vicars, and imagine all the properties we will inherit. All those empty churches can become viharas for monks. And I know that Venerable Chanda, she wants to live in the country, but I want Buckingham Palace as the new Bhikkhuni Vihara for Venerable Chanda. It has many rooms, it has a beautiful garden in the back, lots of parking, and security is very easy. That is my plan.
Hallelujah.
Do you think it won't work? That's negative thinking! You're stopping it working! I like having fun. So anyway, if Queen Elizabeth becomes a Buddhist, you know who did it. Okay, another question before I do something more silly. Yes, go on.
Is it ever worth asking for forgiveness?
No.
And if you do, is there a good way of doing it?
It's usually just give forgiveness. The only person who can forgive you is yourself. Yeah, you can ask forgiveness from a God, from a Jesus, from a monk. But really, all you're really doing is actually acknowledging the mistake and saying, you deserve forgiveness. Why does another person need to convince you that you do deserve forgiveness?
So it's just forgiving yourself.
Exactly. Instead of asking forgiveness for other people. No, people actually do that as a ceremony, and it really sort of tires me out. So what I do, when people actually ask, it's a ceremony in Buddhism. No, Venerable Chanda will probably, it's a ceremony. She will say, Ajahn Brahm, anything I did in the last couple of weeks, please forgive me. And I tell her, I forgive you for everything you've ever done in the past, by body, speech or mind. I forgive you for everything you're ever doing now by body, speech and mind. And I also forgive you for anything you'll ever do in the future to the coming of Maitreya the Buddha by body, speech and mind. You're pre-forgiven. So you don't need to bother me with forgiveness anymore. And I quote for each one of you. You're already pre-forgiven. Okay? So stop bothering me. Of course I forgive you. It's a given. So you're already forgiven. You can do whatever you like. Blank check. You're pre-forgiven. Why not? Can you say that to your husband? To your wife? Darling, whatever you do, by body, speech or mind, now, in the past, in the future, you know you'll always be forgiven. Because I love you, I care for you, you're my partner in this life. You're already pre-forgiven. I may not sort of like it, but you're forgiven, so please let me know what you did. And we can work it out together. We can make sure that, you know, I can be there for you. For example, you know, your husband just, you know, like, you know, falls in, not in love, falls in lust with a woman in his office. You know, boys do that. You know, it's just their hormones. So, you know, he's really fancies somebody in his office and he hides it from you because he's afraid. Tell her straight away so you can help him. They'll say, well, look, yeah, I know. Thank you for telling me. Maybe, you know, you can move to another office. Maybe I can have a word with the boss, get her moved or something. Because the two of you together can do much more than just one person by themselves. So for goodness sake, if you have any problems like that, tell your partner. Trust them. But for goodness sake, encourage that trust by not scolding him. If they do that, then he'll lie to you. The same the other way around, the girl. Forgiveness is just, to me, it's just an unobvious thing we should do. Don't go punishing people. You know, sometimes that people say, oh, that really bad guy, he killed my son. You can put him in jail, but, you know, he only suffers for 20 years. I suffer for the rest of my life. My son has been killed. He's dead. You know, the truth of the matter is, because I've seen people like this, after 2 or 3 years, they're back to normal again. They forget about their son. Not totally, but it's not a big problem anymore. We do get over these things. So people who say, I can never forgive that person because I'm always hurting, they don't always hurt. We heal. Everybody heals. But the person who's in jail, they're the ones, unless they have a good counselor, never heal. So they go out and do the same again. It's not in the interest, it's not, it doesn't make any sense to me why we have a punitive system. It's mostly because of your newspapers. Throw the guy away. Evil incarnate. And that just, that journalism just has no forgiveness at all. Which is terrible. Okie dokie. If there's no more questions. Oh, there is one, yeah, go on.
How do we use the E word, enlightenment, in normal society?
Enlightenment in normal society.
In Britain, it's, there's a lot of things about mindfulness and all of these things, but it's like, as soon as we use the enlightenment word, we might be thought of as flaky or over-ambitious and arrogant. Or
what?
How do we use that word in this society?
In this society, it is the goal of Buddhism, but, and sorry I said this afternoon, you heard me say this, that when I was at school, through scholarships, I went to a good school, and there was a chaplain at that school, an Anglican chaplain. So one day I went up to him, you know, because I was interested, I was actually really sincere about religion. So I asked him, look, I just cannot understand this thing called God. What is it? Explain it to me. No, I'm really serious. I really want to know. I'm not challenging you. Just let me know. You're the expert, the chaplain. Let me know. And he said, God is ineffable, beyond words. The beginning and end of all things, the ground of all being, the A to Z of existence. And my reaction was, what the hell does that mean? You know, the ineffable, beyond words. To me, it showed he didn't know what he was talking about. If you know something, you can describe it. The A to Z, or no, the Alpha to Omega. The A to Z was the street directory in London. The Alpha and Omega of all things. Anyway, I went away thinking the guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And later on, I became a Buddhist. And I went to see this monk. And asked him, enlightenment, what is enlightenment anyway? You know what he told me? He said, it's beyond words. Beginning of animals. That's the same bullshit. And I said, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about either. But when you go and see someone like an Ajahn Chah, you ask those questions, you get answers you can understand. So, finish off, I've only got 5 minutes. It's a story, many of you have heard it before. But it's the best description of enlightenment and the one you can use and everyone can understand, Buddhist or not. And actually adds an extra little dimension. So, it's a story of 5 children playing the wishing game. The rules go like this. Each child has a wish and the one who comes up with the best wish wins the wishing game. First kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a new computer game. He liked playing computer games. Fair enough. Second kid said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a computer game shop. That way I can get many computer games, and when the next new one comes out, I'll be able to buy that as well, because I own the shop. That's obviously a superior wish. The third kid did far better than that. Said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $100 billion US. With my $100 billion US, the first thing I'd do would be buy my own computer game shop. But there's a problem. Because even though I own the shop, my mother will not let me play computer games until I finish my homework. So the second thing I'd buy is my own school. If I own the school and pay the teachers, then they cannot mark me down for homework, which I don't do. They will give me top marks, otherwise I'll give them the sack. So that way I will be able to play computer games every evening and still finish school. And after finishing school, then I'll buy my own university, thereby getting a degree, maybe a BA, an MA, and maybe even give myself a PhD, and spend all the time playing computer games. And with $100 billion US, I'll be able to buy whatever I want, whenever I want it, because no person in the whole world can spend $100 billion US in 1 year, except the British government. And that was obviously winning so far. And the fourth kid did much better than that. And don't say $200 billion US, because $100 billion US or $200 billion US is literally more money than you can ever spend. So the fourth kid did much better. He said, if I had a wish, I would have three wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'd have the computer game shop. For my second wish, I'd have $100 billion US. And for my third wish, I'd have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. And the fourth child won the wishing game. He said, if I had a wish I was so content I never needed any wishes ever again. That was the Buddha describing enlightenment. So content you don't need any more wishes. Nothing missing anymore. The fourth child, infinity of wishes, that is what Donald Trump aspires for. He's got so much money, one urges him to want to become President of the United States for power. So when he has a wish, he can get his wish completed. And infinity of wishes is the myth of power. And the third kid, $100 billion US, that is Bill Gates. So much money, he can get whatever he wants whenever he wants it. And that's what many people aspire towards. Great wealth, great power, but beating all of that is so content you never needed any wishes ever again. That is enlightenment. And you can all understand that. That's neat. So there we go. I hope you're so content you never need to ask any more questions, because that's all you're getting for tonight. Have a good night. See you next year when we get a bhikkhuni monastery in Brighton. Who knows? It's now up to you. Okay. Have a good night. You've got a donation bucket in the end over there. We never charge for people coming in. We only charge for them coming out. Going out. Okay. Always free entry. But we'll let you out. Okay, have a good night and see you next time.